Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com.
And by MX Publishing. New Sherlock Holmes novels, biographies, graphic novels, and short story collections. The largest catalog of new Sherlock Holmes books in the world. Find them online at mxpublishing.com. I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 197, The Art of Deception.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Bigger Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Hello and welcome once again to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Bert Walder.
Oh, my ears don't deceive me. That's a good thing, Bert.
No, my ears don't deceive me, and I'm happy because I can actually hear you, which is something I wasn't able to do during the interview that we're going to be listening to a little bit.
I know. Well, our listeners will be pleased to have an iHose interview devoid of my voice. That's a relief. In the meantime, I will blather on at you for just about 30 seconds or so to remind you that the show notes for this episode can be found at ihose.co/ihose197, and that takes you to ihearofsherlock.com, our homepage and the source of all things related to Sherlock Holmes. Feel free to sign up for an email subscription there and subscribe to our podcast on whatever audio player you use to listen to podcasts. We do appreciate your ongoing support through PayPal and Patreon. It's what makes our show go around, and we are finally getting to the point where we've got enough to go through some of our back catalog and put some transcripts together. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's get over to our distinguished guest.
Well, if you look back in history, it's not an unusual thing for an accomplished medical professional for himself to become an accomplished writer. And since Arthur Conan Doyle, there is at least another such person who's achieved that status, and that's our guest today, Len Goldberg, who is the internationally best-selling author of the Joanna Blaylock series of medical thrillers. His novels been acclaimed by critics as well as fellow authors. His work's been translated into a dozen languages. He sold more than a million copies worldwide. And at this particular time in history, when medical matters are more on the front page than not, Len is also a consulting physician affiliated with the UCLA Medical Center, where he holds an appointment as clinical professor of medicine. He's a highly sought-after expert witness in medical malpractice trials. He's board certified in internal medicine, hematology, and rheumatology. He's published over 100 scientific studies in peer-reviewed journals. But today he's joining us because he is the author of The Art of Deception, published just in June by Minotaur Books, A Daughter of Sherlock Holmes Mystery. So, Len, welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, we're delighted to have you join us. And let's begin with the question we ask all of our guests. When was it, when you look back in your reading history, when did you first encounter Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, I remember it quite vividly because my brother and I were big fans of the Sherlock Holmes series, when it featured Basil Rathbone. And we were just mesmerized by Basil Rathbone, and we loved his depiction of Sherlock Holmes, who we thought of as a super detective who could outwit the evilest of criminals.
And when did you – was your brother younger, older? Are you both pretty close in years?
Yeah, he was 2.5 years older than I was.
Oh, and so you're encountering the films on the television, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, many people that we've talked to over the years harken back to those great Universal Pictures as their first encounter with Sherlock Holmes. And when did you first pick up a Holmes story? When did you first read one of the cases?
I began reading Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, as a teenager, and I was 15 or 16 years old. And my two topics, which just fascinated me, were sea stories, ocean-going stories, such as those by C.S. Forrester, and the Arthur Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes mysteries. And I eventually had to buy the Sherlock Holmes book with all of his adventures and what have you. And I must tell you, I read it so many times, it became dog-eared. I just could read the stories over and over and find new things with each reading, which I think that's true of all Sherlock Holmes lovers. There's always something new if you look for it.
Yes. Yeah, now I need to confirm that we're actually recording because the recording the recording is still on, says Scott. Okay, so we'll just edit this part out. Well, that's great because, you know, particularly as you must remember from the earliest experience we have of Watson that he's reading, I think it's the sea stories of Clark Russell, but, you know, you mentioned Forrester.
Yeah.
That's grand. Well, you know, so Conan Doyle made an early impression on you. What was your household like? I mean, did you grow up in sort of a literary kind of environment? Were you an avid big reader when you were a child?
Well, I was an avid reader, and my brother likewise was an avid reader. My father was quite an avid reader as well. An interesting story, my dad. He wanted to be a physician, and at the age of 18, he was already a sophomore in college and literally on his way to medical school when his father unexpectedly died. Mm. And he had to leave college to work and support the family, his mother and his six brothers and sisters. But he always read things about medicine all of his life. And he had a remarkable memory for things like an anatomy that related to medicine and what have you. And I was often amazed at how much he remembered having never really gone to medical school. It always surprised me. But yeah, he was a big reader. I think some of that rubbed off on my brother and I.
Mm. And when did you first begin writing stories yourself? I mean, it certainly sounds like you grew up in a household in which you were encouraged in the pursuit of medicine, but you also had all this literature available. When did you first start writing your own stories?
That's a question that's been asked before, and I've given various answers. But then I guess it was last year it came to me that when I was a junior in high school, at the end of your junior year, you had to write something called a junior essay on any subject you wanted. It had to be 4 or 5 pages, and you could pick whatever topic you wanted. And even then, I was interested in medicine. And I decided I would write my junior essay as if I was a physician way back in history, and tell the people what I had done. And the first line of that essay was, "I am Edward Jenner." And Edward Jenner, of course, was the inventor, the discoverer of the smallpox vaccine. And I went on to list four or five different physician scientists who had made monumental contributions to medicine and to society. And I always remember that as now as being the beginning. And of course, when I got into medicine and graduated, et cetera, and became board certified and a member of the staff at UCLA, I was very interested in research, and that's how I came to publish over 100 scientific papers while there.
Yeah. And I know from looking at your biography, when you were involved in research at UCLA, you encountered a most unusual blood type, which led to your first novel. Do you want to talk just a little bit about that discovery in that book?
Yeah.
And that was when? That was like 1980 or something like that?
Yeah, a little bit before then. We had a patient at UCLA who had a severe anemia, a delightful woman who had a severe anemia that was caused by her own body's immune system making antibodies against red blood cells. In essence, she was destroying her own red blood cells. And whenever we would give her a transfusion of any sort, we tried to match her as best we could, she had a terrible transfusion reaction. And the antibodies against the red blood cells are, for the most part, directed against the Rh factor. And, of course, everybody, for the most part, has some Rh factor on their red blood cells. But lo and behold, we discovered a family whose blood cells did not contain any Rh factor. And it didn't contain blood type A or B. It was like a naked red blood cell. And we said, wow, what would happen if we transfused this delightful woman who was dying with these AB Rh null red blood cells? Could she tolerate them? Well, we gave her blood transfusions and she tolerated it beautifully. So it came to be that these red blood cells were the universal donor. You could give them to anybody and they would accept them. And from that came the idea, well, suppose we had a young woman who's found to be all of her tissues are without antigens, without any proteins on their surface. Suppose this young woman was a universal donor. And just suppose a Howard Hughes character was dying of kidney failure and needed a kidney, but every kidney donor that they attempted to match him with just didn't work. It was a mismatch. But if they could get this woman's kidney, then he would accept it, and he would live longer and longer and longer. The question is how do you get a kidney from a young, successful woman? And that is the novel transplant.
And it was an enormous hit, you know.
I think the publisher at the time, I was with Dutton Signet, and it came out just in paperback, and I thought it would be fine, and wonderful. It was accepted, and it was not going to be a big part of my life. And lo and behold, it went through 7 or 8 reprintings, and that was the start of it.
Were you ever tempted to say to yourself, gee, you know, I've got a gift here for novel writing. I mean, maybe I need to do more of this and less of medicine.
Well, that never struck me. I wanted to do both. I'm always reminded of the story that's told of Anton Chekhov, the famous Russian physician writer, who was being interviewed, and somebody said, oh, Dr. Chekhov, I know you're a physician, but now you're a famous writer, et cetera, et cetera. Have you ever thought of giving up medicine and devoting all of your time to writing? And Chekhov's memorable reply was, oh, no, never. You see, medicine is my wife and writing is my mistress.
That's a great quotation.
Yeah, and I think most of the physicians I know who are writers feel the same way. They could never give up medicine. But it's interesting. Mm. I have never met a writer who wanted to be a physician. But I met a lot of physicians who wanted to be writers.
Well, that too, I think, is because, you know, when you have the discipline of writing research papers and organizing your thinking, you know, you already accomplish a good deal in terms of structuring writing, putting clear sentences.
I've often said to people that if you read a discharge summary of a patient who had a complex illness, you're really looking at a mystery novel. You really are. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Mm. Did you
if
ever?
If you want, I can tell you how it would go. It would take, you know, just a minute to explain it to you if you would like.
Sure. Yes, please.
Well, let's take a complex patient. A patient has a complex disease that nobody can decide. Nobody knows what the cause of it is. Well, the patient, of course, is the victim, and the disease is the perpetrator. And the consulting physician, of course, is the detective, the savior. And he has to gather clues, i.e. x-rays, blood tests, and what have you, to put together the shape and form of the crime so he can chase the perpetrator, which he finally catches and destroys or imprisons, except in the discharge summary, of course, the patient is cured either by surgery or by medicine. So there are a lot of similarities between a discharge summary and a mystery novel. And when you think about it, the fact of the matter is every time a doctor sees a new patient, it's the start of a mystery.
Mm. Well, and also following the logic of the physician, you know, there are people and there are series and magazines where, you know, they're on a regular basis. I think of one in the New York Times magazine every weekend where you meet a patient who's got a very, well, I mean, a set of symptoms and the unraveling and the tracing and the diagnosis and the therapy and the response and the problem solving really is enormously involving.
Oh, yeah. I have a close friend who's a nurse. I've known her forever. And she reads the New York Times religiously. And she always calls me on Sunday and says, tell me what the diagnosis is on this. And I get it about half the time. But half the time I come up with a pretty good answer. Yeah. But they are very complex. And you have to remember that physicians in general are detectives.
Mm.
And you have to keep in mind that Arthur Conan Doyle was a physician.
Yes, absolutely. And so did you, you know, like Joseph Bell, who was a great inspiration for Sherlock Holmes, in your as a professor at UCLA Medical Center, in your sessions with students, have you ever used storytelling or emphasized observation? Because, you know, when you read The Art of Deception, you know, you can certainly see your characters are particularly attuned to, you know, various physical symptoms and draw some great deductions from them.
Well, as a matter of fact, on occasion I would do exactly that. For example, just to give you a quick example, I would be teaching the diagnosis to, say, juniors in medical school. And as I was giving the lecture, I would have someone suddenly walk in to the lecture room and limp across and go out the door. And, of course, the students were astounded. You know, who was this? It comes in and leaves and all. You know, what was that all about? And I said, well, we're about to find out how observant you are. Tell me, why was that man limping? And there was this silence, and somebody would say, well, obviously he has an injured leg. And I would say, how do you know it's injured? said, because he limped. And I said, well, I said, but suppose I told you he had a stroke, and that's why he limped. And everybody said, gee, that's possible. He did. He might have had a stroke. And I said, no, that's unlikely, because he was moving his arms so well, and usually a stroke gets an arm and a leg. So what we probably have here is an injury. Now, what sort of trauma would do that? And then it would go on and on and on. And what it taught them is to look and see and deduct. So, yeah, there is a way that you can focus people in the way Sherlock Holmes used to do it. That is, don't overlook anything, because the smallest, most trivial clue can sometimes lead to the most important deduction.
That's a great example. And clearly you've put that to use, you know, first with the Joanna Blaylock series, in which your character is a forensic pathologist, you know, rather than someone who's treating a patient. But you have a forensic pathologist at a university medical center who happens to have this very Sherlockian knack for solving murders. And there've been a good series of the Joanna Blaylock stories.
Have you ever wondered how Joanna Blaylock and this forensic pathologist acquired her talent?
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you how. She is the granddaughter of the original Joanna. The genes of Sherlock Holmes runs in her blood.
So your starting point was Joanna Blaylock, and that took you back to the daughter of Sherlock Holmes, did it?
Exactly.
Yeah. So what was the origins of that idea? I mean, when you first created Joanna, did you have that? Was that part of her backstory right away in your
mind? No, it was not. And the way I came about it is, this was halfway through the original Joanna Blaylock series, the modern Joanna Blaylock series, in which a critic said this is a really well-written novel, and it flows so nicely with Joanna Blaylock's Holmesian genius. And I said, oh, wait a minute, Holmesian, she's like Sherlock Holmes. I have to remember that. And eventually that became the daughter of Sherlock Holmes. From that, reviewers commented it was Holmesian.
Ah. And if I remember right, the first Daughter of Sherlock Holmes novel was about 3 years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, 2017. And it's done very, very well. I mean, it's still doing very well. It is now in its 11th reprint.
Oh, that's terrific.
I thought it would do well. I had no idea it would do this well.
What's your sense of how you, this is sort of, I don't know quite how to ask this question, but I'm curious about, you know, this is such a popular area, Sherlock Holmes and also medicine. And so we've seen over the years, Hugh Laurie in the series of House MD, and you clearly have a great kinship with Watson, who was a physician, and also Doyle all the way back to Sherlock Holmes. Do you feel like you're part of that continuum?
I would like to hope so. I just feel that you get swept up in it. It's like a current that picks you up and moves you. And I think it's absurd to fight against it. Why not go with the current?
Mm.
And people always ask me, well, how many of the daughter of Sherlock Holmes novels can they be? And I always respond, how many would you like?
Yeah. Well, there are always problems to unravel, absolutely. And it's interesting, you know, in The Art of Deception, because that's the book that we're talking about now, which was just published by Minotaur in June. It's fascinating, you know, without giving any spoilers away, but one of the things you notice when you look at the book is how relevant in different ways it is to things that are going on in popular culture today. For example, early in the book, one of the things that happens is you become acquainted with a series of mysterious events, crimes, that seem to be very misogynistic. seemed to be very much anti-woman, anti-women. And unfortunately, that's, very much part of the news today.
Yeah, it does seem that that is more prevalent now than it has been in the past, I must say. And I'm not sure why, although I wonder if it's not due to the fact that women now have gained more power, more prestige, a stronger place in our society, and that some find that threatening. Because there's no doubt now. I mean, if you just look at medicine, when I was in medical school, lo, those many years ago, I think 10% of the class was female. Now, you go to virtually any medical school, and half or more of the students are women. It's just a totally reversed situation, which is fine. I mean, if you've got the goods and you've got the brains, why not? But it simply shows you how society, if you will, has evolved, and that women now are taking a much more prominent role in everything. It doesn't have to be just medicine, even in politics. I mean, goodness gracious, we had a woman who ran for president. We're going to have a woman who's going to be a vice presidential candidate. The Speaker of the House is female. Some of our more prominent senators are female. So time and events have changed things for us, haven't they?
Yes, absolutely. And more to come.
Oh, yeah.
And more to come after this brief word.
Martin Freeman, Nigel Bruce, Edward Hardwick, Jude Law, James Mason, Ralph Richardson, Robert Duvall. The list of actors who've played Dr. Watson is just as rich as those who have donned the Deerstalker. Generations have discovered Sherlock Holmes because of the mysteries, but they come back again and again for the characters and for the indispensable Dr. Watson. That's why you will enjoy Anne Margaret Lewis's The Watson Chronicles, a Sherlock Holmes novel in six connected stories that begin as Holmes contemplates retirement in 1900. It's a series of baffling mysteries, including one of the biggest of all, Watson's Wives. The Watson Chronicles by Anne Margaret Lewis understands there's always more to learn about Watson. So it's perfect for those of us who believe the noble doctor never gets enough page time. And it's available right now from our WessExpress.com. So what is, without, getting too mechanical about things, what's your general process when you're thinking about a Daughter of Sherlock Holmes novel? Do you begin to think about, well, first of all, there are some things that always are part of the world of Sherlock Holmes, whether or not it's a Conan Doyle case or the daughter of Sherlock Holmes. There are deductions to be drawn from objects. There are, as you've pointed out, conclusions to be drawn from the physical condition of people. And that features very prominently in The Daughter, in The Art of Deception, as an example, very early on. What's your process? I mean, do you start by thinking about, what might be observed and...
What I initially do is I have a thought of what might be the topic, the subject of a good Daughter of Sherlock Holmes novel. And I let it spin around in my head for 4 or 5, sometimes 6 weeks. And if it gets better and better and more complex, great, I've got a novel. If it seems to fade or wither on the vine, I let it go. So after 5 or 6 weeks of percolating, so as to speak, if it's still in my head and still going strong, I've got a novel. Now, I know the beginning, and I know the end. I have no idea what's going to happen in between. it sort of reminds me of this wonderful mystery writer, Walter Mosley. Have you ever read any of this?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. What an ace.
He's just a grand writer. Anyhow, he was being interviewed once. And he said, it's like being in a hotel in a strange city, and you walk out the front door, and you just don't know where it's going to take you. And I think that's what happens when you begin to write. The first couple of three chapters, it's tough going as you formulate, put things together, set things in action. But once things are moving along, suddenly the characters take over the book and you just write about it.
Yep, they show you where they want to go.
Yeah, yeah. And they dictate too.
Yeah.
And on occasion, the direction is not what you plan. For example, you have a character who is somewhat despicable, and you kill that character off in chapter 7 or chapter 8, and your editor says, no, you shouldn't do that. No, this person is perfect to hate. You've got to leave her in them. Don't kill her off until chapter 20 if you must kill her off. So sometimes you're taken down a path that may not be the best. But editors are very good at this, as you probably know.
Mm-hmm.
You show me a very good novel, and I'll show you a very good editor.
Mm. Yeah, you really benefit from that expertise.
Well, it sort of reminds me that a really good editor makes you believe that you really knew what you were doing from the onset.
Without giving anything away, without any spoilers here, can you tell our listeners a little bit about the world of the daughter of Sherlock Holmes? You know, who is telling us these stories and where it fits in terms of time, where in the early 20th century are we and who these people are?
Sure. Let's go back to the beginning, in which we find out that there is a daughter of Sherlock Holmes that is unknown to the world. But it just so happens that this daughter of Sherlock Holmes, who demonstrates her brilliance as a nurse and what have you, loses her first husband to cholera. And fortunately, she is the daughter-in-law of a very wealthy and well-known statesman, Lord Blaylock. And he takes Joanna and her son into his household so that they live a life of wealth and privilege. And one day, Joanna is walking down Curzon Street with her young son when someone falls to their death, and Scotland Yard is called, and they name it a suicide. And, of course, Joanna knows it's not a suicide. The family of the person who died consults with Dr. Watson, who still lives at 221 B. Baker Street. Sherlock Holmes is long dead, but people still come to see Watson for advice. And the daughter of the sister of the man who felt his death, comes to see Watson, Dr. Watson, and begs him to look into the case. And, of course, Watson's not terribly interested in this. Suicide is not his cup of tea. But then she mentions that Joanna Blaylock actually witnessed this and has a different opinion on what the cause of death was. Well, Watson almost comes out of his chair, because Watson is one of the only people on the face of the earth who know that Joanna Blaylock is the daughter of Sherlock Holmes. And so it begins.
Mm.
Now, Dr. Watson, who is now elderly, still involved in advice and criminal investigation, what have you, but not to a great extent, relies on his son to be his aid and his sounding board. And his son is also a physician, a pathologist at St. Bartholomew's Hospital. And the investigation goes on, and, of course, Joanna reveals that she is brighter than anybody else and can solve this crime. And she falls in love with the dashing young Dr. Watson, and they marry. And they then all live at 221B Baker Street, the senior Dr. Watson, and Joanna Blaylock and her new husband, Dr. Watson Jr. And they form a consulting and investigative team, and they do very, very well. And the novels are about Joanna Blaylock's remarkable ability to solve crimes, just like her esteemed father. And the novels are told or chronicled by her husband, John Watson Jr.
Ah, it's a great summary. You know, our listeners will find in The Art of Deception the latest case of the daughter of Sherlock Holmes. I think it's, you know, it's interesting. You have a dedication at the very, very beginning of the book from Ecclesiastes. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. And that's very relevant to the story you're telling. But, boy, there is always something new. And it's lovely to see how you've continued the atmosphere of Baker Street, evolved these characters, continue to present these puzzles for your readers to enjoy.
Well, I think that the fact of the matter is that most things have been written about. And it happens in the strangest ways. Can I give you a brief example?
Please do.
Now, we're all familiar with Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park, are we not?
Yes.
It's one of the best-selling novels of all time. So entertaining. So, it just grabs your attention. The movie and the novel. And, of course, the basis of the novel is that dinosaurs come back to life and terrorize human beings, which is a great idea. And I think we all say, well, that's wonderful. How did Michael Crichton come up with that idea? What a fantastic tale. How did he come up with it? Well, I'll tell you how he came up with it. He copied it. If you go back 100 years, a novel written by author Conan Doyle, the very same author Conan Doyle we know and love, he wrote a novel that revolves around a group of explorers in the Amazon who become lost, and they eventually come to this hidden high plateau, and on that plateau reside dinosaurs. And, of course, those dinosaurs attack them and kill some of them. Now, think about that. Isn't that remarkably similar to what Crichton's novel is about? Now, you say, well, wait a minute, is it that close? Well, yeah, it's very close. And let me tell you why. Crichton and his genius, rather than putting the dinosaurs up on some hidden plateau, situated them on an island off the coast of Costa Rica. And Crichton used bioengineering to bring back those dinosaurs, rather than having them isolated on some mountaintop, untouched by man. So you can see the similarities between the stories. And you might ask, well, yeah, but how do you know that Michael Crichton copied it? Well, I never met Crichton. I never chatted with him, but I'm certain he copied it. Now, how? How do I know that? Well, Michael Crichton wrote a sequel to Jurassic Park, and the sequel was titled Jurassic Park, The Lost World. And the title of Arthur Conan Doyle's novel written 100 years ago about those dinosaurs, the title was The Lost World. I think Michael Crichton was paying homage to the great Arthur Conan Doyle from which he got that idea.
So what's next for the daughter of Sherlock Holmes? Have you started yet to think about another one in the series, and any possible intersection with Sea Stories, you know, and Forrester?
I don't think I'm going to do Sea Stories, although I have one in mind, I must tell you. The Art of Deception is novel number 4. I have just completed novel number 5.
Ah.
And it is now in the editor's hands. And my editor is Pete Wolverton, who is just an outstanding editor, just 5-star. And they like the novel so much that they've now extended my contract, so they want an additional two more after that. So there's at least seven Dr. Sherlock Holmes novels in the making, and I suspect there'll be a few more after that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, that's good news for your readers and good news for the world of Sherlock Holmes.
Well, again, I think Sherlock is just so special. It's just remarkable. Again, what makes Sherlock Holmes so special? What in the world does it? Does anybody know? You can say, wait a minute. I mean, he's this remarkable ability to make so much from so little. Well, I mean, Nero Wolfe did the same thing. Rex Stout did the same thing. They were outstanding. Ellery Queen, outstanding detectives. Why Sherlock? Why? It's a real question, isn't it?
Now, it is. Go ahead. I can give you
a partial answer.
Yes, please.
Now, we have to start from the get-go that everybody loves Sherlock Holmes because he has this remarkable ability to make so much from so little. He can take a trivial clue and really make remarkable deductions from it, which is great. But is that enough for his popularity to go over 100 years and be more popular now than he ever was? I mean, Sherlock Holmes is the most frequently portrayed character in film and television. Nobody comes close. And anybody who portrays Holmes, whether it's Basil Rathbone or Jeremy Brett or this Cumberland fella who now is on television, we immediately love them because they're Sherlock Holmes to us, right?
Right.
So why do it? Well, maybe it's because he's a bright fella. In addition, well, he's not all that bright. If you listen to his good friend and colleague Watson, yeah, Sherlock is remarkable as a detective, but he's not a genius. He's pretty well-founded in chemistry and anatomy, but only as it applies to crime. And he knows nothing of philosophy, nothing of politics, and could care less. And you say, well, yeah, but he has this unique quality that, wait a minute, a lot of people have a unique quality. What about the doctor who is so renowned that he can make the diagnosis when nobody else can, or the lawyer who wins every case because he weaves his magic in a courtroom, or the musician who brings forth a sound from that instrument that just mesmerizes you. Yet they don't last 100 years. Well, I'll tell you what I think part of his charm is, Sherlock's charm. I think it's his flaws. Because you see, as bright as Sherlock is, he's really a messy, lazy fellow. Think about it. Mm. He can lay on that sofa for days on end. He has to inject himself with cocaine to get off the couch. Just lays around. He's messy. He puts his tobacco in the shoe of a Persian slipper. He puts his cigars in a coal bucket. He has notes and newspapers scattered all around the room at 221B Baker Street. And he can be very, very unsociable. He has no desire to make friends. He doesn't care. So you say, well, how is this so appealing to us? Well, the point of the matter is that Sherlock lives life exactly as he wants to. He doesn't care what you think or feel. He doesn't care. He does what he wants, when he wants. He doesn't care about politics. He doesn't care about matters of love or heart. He just doesn't care about it. He is unidirected to crime and his life, and that's all he wants to do. And everything else, he just pushes aside. So if you put all this together, what have you got? Well, you have a very unique guy who has this remarkable ability to detect and deduct. And on the other side, he's kind of a lazy layabout who is totally unsociable, just totally. And when you think about it, that's what makes him so remarkable. Think on it for a minute. Here is a guy whose talents we adore and whose flaws we happily forgive. We don't even think of him. Of course. He is a unique combination of what we yearn to be and in some measure what we already are. And I think that's what makes him so special.
Mm. Well, Len Goldberg, that is a great summary, a brilliant summary of what we find attractive and enduring and eternal in the world of Sherlock Holmes. And thank you for taking Sherlock Holmes' association with Irene Adler, which produced the daughter of Sherlock Holmes, and bringing these characters in Baker Street and these wonderful stories to life for this new generation of readers. And thanks so much for joining us today. What a treat to talk to you.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I should end with a little bit of a humorous note, if you'll forgive me.
Yes.
If you'll allow me. Somebody wrote a criticism of the novel, The Daughter of Sherlock Holmes, and she said, "How could you allow Sherlock to be involved with her in a drunken, drug-induced one-night stand?" And my response was, "Oh, it was easy, because you see, Sherlock has the same flaws that we all have." So it was fun, and I must say, I enjoy my writing. I enjoy those novels, and I've enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for inviting me, and I hope that sometime in the future you will invite me back again.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We'd love to. We'd love to. Thanks so much, Len.
Thank you again. Goodbye now.
Bye-bye.
Well, I have to tell you, Bert, now that I've actually had a chance to listen to that interview, why don't we explain to our listeners exactly what happened? When things kicked off, I was in listen-only mode because my computer wasn't picking up my microphone, and we tried to reboot and reconnect with Len, and it just wasn't working. So I went to audio-only mode, listening in and feeding you all of the insightful questions you asked. And then at one point toward the end of the interview, I had to get up and leave simply because my wife's car broke down and I needed to go get her and the kids. So it was just one of those days in IHO's lore.
Yeah, it's one of those days where sort of one thing goes wrong after another and just builds up into a mountain of challenges. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you're here now, and that's all that matters.
That is. And look, I think Len gave a fantastic interview. I mean, it was just wonderful to hear how his mind worked about these things and his own history and, you know, the details of his childhood and of his medical profession and the rest. I thought he, you know, just provided a lot more nuance to this series than one would have otherwise expected.
Yes, I love talking to Len. It was fascinating to listen to his explanation about the origins of Sherlock Holmes, you know, that he does what he wants and that he has flaws and that he's very genuine. But his point that, you know, we envy Holmes, I really like that. I mean, that's sort of tangential and related to what Edgar Smith would say about Sherlock Holmes. And it's also interesting what he had to say about he's encountered many doctors who want to write, but very few writers, if any, want to get into medicine. And I think that's certainly true. I can't tell you, I've hardly ever had the desire to do a tracheotomy or set a fracture.
I probably would concur with you. I did want to be a doctor at one point in my life, but that science thing got in the way. So I just stuck with a career in communications and the human social science aspect of it, which is why I always enjoyed, you know, when I was in medical school and following doctors, I always enjoyed the history that doctors took from patients. And when you think about what Conan Doyle learned from Joseph Bell, it was very much in the observation and the discussion, the history, that each patient would bring that provided so much more information and nuance than, you know, running blood tests or whatnot. Well, once again, we are here with our second sponsor, MX Publishing. Pleased to have them as an ongoing sponsor for the show. And we wanted to talk a little bit about a recent Kickstarter campaign that just closed. It is Jeremy Brett playing a part. And even though the Kickstarter is closed, the book is still available for purchase. Now, the Kickstarter was for a biography of Jeremy Brett by Maureen Whittaker. And this is a little different than other Jeremy Brett works that we've seen in the past, isn't it, Bert?
Oh, yeah. This has got a foreword from David Burke, who our listeners will remember played the first Dr. Watson alongside Brett in the series. And it's a real review. You know, Jeremy Brett had been a very successful actor for 30 years before he was cast as Sherlock Holmes. And what the publishers have done here is bring together probably the most comprehensive review of Brett's career on stage, on screen. And it's got certainly over 100 rarely seen and a couple of exclusive photographs. So it should be really, really relevant and interesting to Sherlockians.
Yeah. And we'll have a link to the site because the book goes live, gets published on September 12th, which of course is the anniversary of Jeremy Brett's death 35 years ago. Can you believe it's been 35 years already? It's,
no,
25 years ago. Is that right? 1995. That's right. 95. 25 years ago. 25 years. Quarter of a century has been gone. But you can order a color hardback or paperback and a black and white paperback version. And wanted to just note too that, as part of the Kickstarter, we helped to drive some more, supporters of Kickstarter with our post about it. And once MX reached the 100 backer level, they committed to their stretch goal, which means 100 trees will be planted in Jeremy Brett's honor at the Happy Life Children's Home in Kenya as part of their Books to Trees campaign. So we here at I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere are proud to be part of that. Well, that tune means it's time once again for everyone's favorite Sherlockian quiz show. That's right, it's Canonical Couplets. We give you two lines of poetry and ask you to identify the story from the Sherlock Holmes canon. And if you remember, the last time around, we gave you this clue. Gregson and Lestrade made contributions minimal. Within 3 days, Holmes's hand was on the criminal. And Bert, do you know which story that canonical couplet refers to?
Oh, yes, that's very easy. That's the story about those thieves in India who all drank beer from the same jug. That was the Stein of the Four.
Oh. I say nine to that, as our German friends would say.
Wrong again, huh?
Wrong once again, Bert. No, the answer, of course, that we were looking for was A Study in Scarlet. A Study in Scarlet, yeah, being completely given away by the mention of both Gregson and Lestrade. I think that is one of two stories that Inspector Gregson appears in that we have. So there you go. Well, we did have a number of people putting their guesses in the hat this time around. I think the canonical couplets, as we're on the second round here, they are a little bit easier, a little more accessible to everyone. And we hope that encourages people to participate. And as a result, we're going to give an extra big spin to the big prize wheel to see who we get for our prize of commissionaire by Sonia Featherston. And it looks like we land on number 25. 25. And that corresponds to Rob Nunn. Rob, congratulations. We'll be sending you that copy of Commissionaire, Julian Wolfe and His Baker Street Irregulars. All right, so that means it's now time for this episode's canonical couplet, which is... Followed back to Baker Street, Holmes endured a rare defeat. If you know the answer to this episode's canonical couplet, put it in an email addressed to comment at ihearofsherlock.com with canonical couplet in the subject line. If you are right, you will be among the potential winners that we select from the hat. Good luck. And of course, this time around, our winner will receive a copy of Leonard Goldberg's The Art of Deception. So that's quite an incentive right there to participate in the quiz.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Well, Bert, I think we've done it again. This final episode of July 2020. We will be back next month in just a fortnight's time in August with our next fantastic episode. Do you know who we're going to have on?
Wait a minute. Let me look at my calendar. Let me find my notes. Let me get these little scribbled. No, I don't.
I don't either. So it'll be a wonderful surprise for everyone, including us.
Yes.
In the meantime, I remain the entirely predictable Scott Monty.
And I am the inevitable Burt Wilder.
And together we say, the games of foot.
the games of foot.
I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I am neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.